Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
At the age of 23, after leaving graduate school to pursue her dreams of becoming a poet, Joanna Rakoff moved to New York City and took a job as assistant to the storied literary agent for J.D. Salinger. She was tasked with answering Salinger's voluminous fan mail, but as she read the candid, heart-wrenching letters from his readers around the world, she found herself unable to type out the agency's decade-old form responses. Instead, she abandoned the template and began writing back. She tells the story in her wonderful new memoir, My Salinger Year. She's also author of the novel, A Fortunate Age, and it's a pleasure to welcome Joanna Rakoff to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
This is such a beautiful book because it brings us back to a time, and yet it brings us back to a time in the 90s that perhaps we weren't expecting to be brought back to.
Yes. I had been asked to write this book for about 10 years, and the moment that the idea became exciting to me was when I realized that this year that I worked at the agency, 1996, was an incredibly interesting year. It was this year when the world, the Western world at least, kind of dove off a cliff into the digital age. And so I was so interested in that moment when you could still have an entity like this agency that I worked at, in which there were no computers, there was no voicemail, the Xerox machine was considered a newfangled invention, but that agency could still sort of get by. And now that would no longer be possible. They couldn't keep up in any way.
And this was mostly, not entirely, but mostly because their biggest client was J.D. Salinger.
Do you mean that's why they sort of had this kind of retro
approach?
Well,
meaning that was as cutting edge as they were getting, right?
Yes. And they were a bit frozen in their golden age. So they had been a huge agency in the 20s, the 30s, through, let's say, the 50s. And then they sort of began to plateau. Most of their big clients were, say, from the 20s through the 50s. Their other huge client was F. Scott Fitzgerald. So they did make an enormous amount of money off of Fitzgerald's estate, you know, his stories and novels, of course.
I was fascinated. You don't name the agency. You refer to it just as the agency.
Yes.
I assume that was a conscious decision.
It was. It was partly a stylistic choice. As I said, after years of saying no, I said yes to writing this book. And then once I actually sat down to write it, found that I had no idea what tone or style to take, which is to say, as a writer, I'm not so inclined to write about myself. I've written a few personal essays, one of which turned into this book, but I tend to write about other people. And as a novelist, I write these kind of big social books. I'm in the middle of one now that's very much about the recession. And it was hard for me to figure out how to write about myself. So I, while struggling to figure out how to approach this book, went and read 50 or 60 memoirs. I'd not read that many memoirs. And I tried to figure out what I liked and what worked and what didn't. And I realized that I really loved certain memoirs that had a very stylized approach. My own, this book is not so stylized in the end, but I loved I loved books like Joan Didion's Blue Nights, where a lot of information is kind of withheld from you.
Yes.
Once I kind of settled on just calling the agency, there's a character known as my college boyfriend. I only call him my college boyfriend. My boss is only called my boss.
Right.
Once I settled on that, I was able to really sink into writing the book. I don't know if part of it also just had to do with fear of writing about real people and real things. And so calling them by these sort of anonymous markers or whatever made it easier to write about them.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, is it a way of protection, both for you and for them?
Yeah, it is, certainly. Exactly. It allowed me to step back, to sort of remove myself a little bit from the picture and think of it more like a novel and less like a book about me.
Right. And how did you get the job?
I got the job just by accident. I had been in grad school in London. I had essentially dropped out. I finished my master's. I was supposed to go on to do my doctorate. I just left and came back to New York where my parents were. I was kind of hanging around. I wrote my master's thesis, but was also, you know, going to parties. A lot of my friends were in New York, and worked as a PA on a Barbra Streisand film, which sounds glamorous and fun, but was really horrible, actually. And at a party, a friend said, gave me a business card and said, go to this placement agency and they'll find you a job in publishing in a second. And I had never wanted to work in publishing. I didn't even know what that meant. But I thought, oh, maybe this is fate. I called the placement agency, and within a day, I had this job, not even knowing what a literary agency was.
And your position within that agency was fairly important in the sense of it was an important part of what they did.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So it was an entry-level position, but the people who tended to have that position before and after me were people who were even just the tiniest bit older than just out of college, because there was a level of kind of security involved. And my boss had to be very sure that whoever she hired was not someone who was going to make a huge error in judgment and give out Salinger's phone number or his address or any information about him to a reporter or anyone, really. That was a big part of the job, which is protecting his privacy. So she, my boss, that is, had very strong ideas about, you know, young girls being silly and that kind of thing, and that, you know, that she needed to hire someone who was sensible and really understood the mission of protecting Salinger.
As far as that mission, one of the fascinating aspects is that even though it is widely known that he was a recluse and he lived a very quiet life, people were reaching out to him. Through the agency, they were reaching out to him. They were writing mail. And that came in quite a volume.
Yes, a pretty large volume. It ebbed and flowed, but there was tons of it. And it came either directly to us or it came to Little Brown, Salinger's publisher, and then was forwarded onto us. And the thing that was always funny to me about it was that, you know, so I was not a Salinger fan when I took the job. I had not read any Salinger. Mm. I was not interested in Salinger. I was not someone who followed Salingerania or whatever you would call it. I don't think I'd ever even had a conversation really about Salinger. And yet I, of course, knew that he was a complete recluse. I, you know, was not even remotely surprised to know that he didn't want to see his fan mail. And yet you had these people, tons and tons of people writing to him, sophisticated people who surely knew this. And yet there was this hope that their letters would somehow get through to them. I think many of the people felt that somehow if their letters were just convincing or perfect or special enough or creative enough, that they would be passed on to Salinger and he would become their best friend.
What was the standard reply?
The standard reply, which had been composed in 1963 and was handed to me as a carbon copy, so on this piece of crumbling yellow paper, essentially said, "Dear Miss or Mrs. So-and-so, thank you for your kind letter to J.D. Salinger. As you may know, Mr. Salinger does not wish to see his fan mail. Thus, we cannot pass your letter on to him. Please do not contact us again," or something to that effect. "Sincerely, me," my name, whoever was the assistant signed his or her own name. And it was really designed to keep the fans at bay, to say, don't be in touch again. Don't write again. And I, you know, when I first started responding to the fans, felt that this letter was just so cruel, because so many of these letters were really confessional, people pouring out their hearts to Salinger in different ways. But there's a lot of care and thought and emotion that went into these letters. And I thought, oh, God, you know, how can they send them this form letter? But as the year went on, I really began to understand why the letter was designed to keep people at bay. Because as I responded to the fans, they would then respond to me. And that's just untenable. You couldn't keep going. And that is, in fact, what happened to Salinger before he kind of stopped the flow, before he put the cork in the hole in the dam, or whatever right. you would call it.
And just said, enough. I'm never going to win this.
Exactly.
So at what point are you reading these letters? Some of them just tortured and tragic, and you share some of them in the book. And it's fascinating because you take a book, his most famous, of course, of A Catcher in the Rye, and the effect that had on young people, that effect that it had certainly on young boys. At what point do you read the letters, read how it impacts them, and say, okay, now I have to read the novel?
It took a while. You would think that it wouldn't, but it did. I had been at the agency for approximately 9 months, 8 or 9 months, when I decided to read all of Salinger's work. And I had already started writing personally to the fans. I'd engaged in correspondence with a few of them. I think what pushed me over the edge, I became just very curious, because the letters would contain these kind of snippets of story. And it became a little bit like an enormous jigsaw puzzle that had all these pieces missing. So I knew about the ducks in Central Park. There were a lot of letters about the ducks in Central Park. I had one letter from a man saying, I visited New York in the winter and the duck last year and the ducks were there. You know, are you sure about this ducks in Central Park thing? Are you sure they go away in the winter? And I myself, you know, had been to Central Park in the winter as a kid often. And I thought, you know, I actually think the ducks were there. But anyway, ducks aside, I became curious. There were a lot of letters asking if Franny and Zoe is pregnant. And I just started to wonder, you know, who are these people? These people, meaning characters in his stories, why have they had such a profound impact on people's lives? And I also just wanted to know. I'm such a story person.
Right.
You know, I love The Moth and This American Life, and I sit in my car until I hear the end of the story, even if it's not one of the strongest ones. And I just wanted to know. I wanted to know who these people were. But I also, by that point, had gotten to know Salinger through our phone calls. And I really liked him. And I thought, I think maybe I've misjudged his work. I had thought that his work was trivial and cutesy and light entertainment. And he himself, in our conversations, did not seem like a writer of light entertainment. So I brought them all home and read them all in a weekend.
Joanna Rakoff's new book is My Salinger Year. It is published by Knopf. Joanna Rakoff will be at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts for Touchstones, Kate Bollock in conversation with Joanna Rakoff, Friday, August 15th at 6 o'clock. You can find out more information by going to edithwharton.org, edithwharton.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.